Welcome back to the Faculty Factory podcast, friends. I'm Kim Skorupski here looking at my colleague and friend, Dr. Wendy Bennett. Hi, Wendy.
Hey, Kim. Thanks for inviting me.
Dr. Wendy Bennett, MD, MPH, is an associate professor of medicine. She's submitting her packet for professor, so we're really excited about that. She's in the Division of General Internal Medicine, where she's also the director of research there. She is here in the School of Medicine and the Bloomberg School of Public Health. She is the director of research not only in general internal medicine, but at the Johns Hopkins Community Physicians. And she's co-director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Women's Health, Sex, and Gender Research. She's held many leadership titles here in the School of Medicine. She's been an officer on Faculty Senate. She ran the Women's Task Force in Department of Medicine for the whole big Department of Medicine for many years. Critically for this conversation today, she has been funded her entire career. And not only is that like a whoop whoop major accomplishment that not a lot of people are managed to do, but she has done this. She has this great ability to build teams that are vibrant, thriving, sustainable teams, many diverse different teams over many different projects. And that skill, I think, is really unique and not really shared. Like, no one really tells you how to build a research team. They may tell you how to deal with HR and how to hire people, but to keep a team together, keep them motivated, develop them, grow them, build those relationships and connections, that is a really rare talent. So she's obviously one of our superstars here, and we're so thrilled to have her on the podcast today. Wendy, again, thank you so much. Tell us, if you don't mind, kind of like set up the journey and drop some wisdom on us for how you have built your research teams over your career.
Yeah, well, this is such a great topic. And I was sharing with you that I recently talked to our fellows in general internal medicine about this topic. And I think what's so important about it is that how to build teams, how to manage, how to support, how to grow people is something that we're never taught. As you said, it certainly isn't anything we're taught in medical school. It might be something that's taught a little bit in business school, but it's like this underappreciated skill, I think. And right now, when it's so hard to hire people and retain them, I think it's become even more important that our staff feel part of something bigger, that they feel supported, that they feel part of, you know, a team. There's a lot of growth opportunities for them. So I definitely feel like I've been working on these, on building these skills, and now trying to share them with others, so that we can all be mindful of, it's a leadership skill, but even more important, I think being a good manager of people is underappreciated. It's like, nobody wants to say, hey, I'm a manager, right? But like, management is actually really, really important, right? How we manage our teams, how we manage our projects, how we manage people, how we assign tasks, how we grow people and support. It's all part of like management. So really quick story. I was trying to remember how I started thinking about this. And actually, when I was on a K award, you know, first building my team, At that time, I really just had a project coordinator working with me. I was fortunate to attend one of the AAMC early career women faculty leadership meetings. It was in beautiful Arizona. And one of the seminars, kind of workshops that I appreciated the most was the one about management, was about, you know, how do you build something? How do you grow something? And sharing like sort of what does it take to be a good manager? And that was really sort of, and I'll share with you some of the pearls that I learned from that. But that in that workshop, they shared books and they shared sort of ways to think about it. You know, it's a little bit of that emotional intelligence part of ourselves, right? That part of your brain where you're tuned into others and you're understanding other people's situations. And it's those skills that, you know, that I think that's what it takes to sort of support and grow, others.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much, Dr. Bennett, for first of all, elevating the conversation, but I love how you're underscoring the management component of this. And you know why? Because when we have all of our leadership courses here at Hopkins, as you know, and you've been involved in many of them, we talk about the difference between leadership and management. And when we talk about leadership competencies, in fact, at the Hopkins, we have this nice rubric. It goes from if you're staff and mid-level management, higher level manager, executive leader, and they're just different behaviors that go with each of those levels of leadership, if you will. And it's almost a distinction between managers do things right and leaders do the right things. I'll say that again. Managers do things right. You know, we go by the book. This is how you do things. You follow the rules, regulations, make sure you're clocking in on time, doing the job, sweeping the floors, whatever. Leaders do the right things, meaning they're kind of triaging and deciding what are the right things to do versus doing things right. And so I kind of always, the way in my mind, set it up that it's like this hierarchical thing that we all want to be leaders. So you have to change your game, lift your game, elevate your game from a manager to a leader. And so being humble here, I'm recognizing that it's not like, don't be a manager, be a leader. Rather, incorporate good management skills to be a leader. The good leaders have to recognize good management and good management skills. So I love how you're pushing me to think about, it's not an either or, because you're clearly a leader. It's a yes and. It's what knowing when, as you're saying, emotional intelligence, when to shift into leadership mode. Like, is this the right thing that we should be doing? And then when to shift and pivot and to the, are we doing things right? And it's both of those. So thank you for opening my eyes to both management and leadership.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think that's exactly right. I think that we need to think about management as part of a leadership skill, because it's really about attracting the right people to our organization, cultivating their talent, supporting them, mentoring them. All of that is management, but it's also a leadership skill, right? And so you can sort of do both. And I think that, you know, we need to sort of elevate managers and management skills as important to that. So some of the things that I learned from this workshop I can share with you. So really thinking about like what makes a successful manager. And I started thinking about this a lot with this idea of emotional intelligence, right? But it's that idea of like being very self-aware too. So knowing how you communicate with people and also how you want to be communicated to, right? Like, and some of this is the introvert extrovert thing. Like, I know that I do not want people knocking on my door all day long because I will never get any work done. But it's also like, I have a lot of expectations for communication that I set up with my staff now, you know, that they, when they meet with me, they come to meetings with agendas, they come prepared, they come with goals. I have meetings with them and that are project-oriented meetings about their work and what they're getting done and where they have questions. And often this sort of a little bit more open-door policy with those types of meetings, like don't wait too long with a question. If you're not figuring it out, let me know or go to someone else on the team. But then I also have career-oriented meetings with them, right? Like making sure that they're happy. I work now with another PI on projects. And so together, she and I do all of our staff reviews. And I just love her approach. I've learned a lot from her. And on all of our reviews, it's really about listening, right? It's about listening to what is important to people, to value the different perspectives that people are bringing. And so one of the things that she always asks are, what are the things that you love about your job right now? And then we listen. And then what are the things that are really challenging right now? Where are you being challenged? And we also try to get at like a little bit in there, what are the things that you don't like? Because sometimes those are things we can change and sometimes they're not. Like sometimes there's things where we need to provide a little more support. And it is this idea of support, like where can we be better coaches for our staff? Where can we find resources for them? Where can we connect them with other resources that our team or our, you know, little group might not have, but are sort of more university-wide? The other thing is, and this is always hard for us, and I think there's a balance, but in meetings, I think there's also an ability of a manager to be like flexible and to own up to their own mistakes, right? So like this idea that like we should be role models and we should say when we're wrong, we should say when we don't get things, we should say when somebody else has a great idea in the room. And so this like, you know, sort of being this sort of flexibility, but also the role modeling of the things that you want your team to do. And I'll tell you that the hardest thing, and we can talk about this maybe a little bit later too, is being aware of team dynamics. So now I have a big research team, and actually it was one team, and then we got a second project, fortunately, and we expanded. So we have, it's almost like Venn diagrams. Some people overlap on the same project, and then there's some people that are on the two other projects that are independent, although more and more they're all coming together. And there's been a lot of sort of conflict, and sometimes I miss the conflict. I know something's going on, but I don't really get it. And they're sort of like, it's almost like parenting, right? Like you want your kids to figure it out themselves. And so sometimes you don't want to interject until you're really needed. On the other hand, if you wait too long, things can sort of blow up and people can be really unhappy. And so I've learned a lot from some of the recent conflicts on my team about how better to support people through it. And also, I think some of it is like preparing for the inevitable of conflicts. Ooh. I don't know. Have you heard of this whole thing, the phases of team development, the forming, storming, norming, performing, journeying? When I hire people now and I onboard them onto my teams, I talk them through these phases now. I say, like, at the beginning, everybody's really excited. We're new. We're getting to know each other. Everybody's in a good mood, right? Like, it's a lot of the connections. But there will come a time where there are conflicts. It's just part of life. It's part of being part of a team. It's part of research teams in particular, because research, you know, as you know, the phases of research and the demands of what you're doing changes so fast, right? You might come in and one minute you're focused on recruiting, the next minute you're focused on something, another aspect of the study, because studies change over time. And there's also the other thing about research when you're soft money funded is there's a little uncertainty too. Like, when's that next grant coming in? And so I think it creates this sort of like inherent like conflict where people feel like they want to be valued, they want to stay on the project. But there's this issue of sort of like, what's my role? Like, where am I going to be most valued? And also, what's my role today when like the project's always changing and there's lots of people doing things? And so where do I fit? And so especially with big teams and where people might have some overlapping things they're doing, I think that a lot of what we've encountered is that the storming moments are where people feel undervalued, they don't feel recognized, and they don't have a good idea of what their role is. Like maybe we tell them like, oh, now you're going to shift and do this. But then they're like, someone else is kind of doing that. And how much of that do I? And it's this role uncertainty that creates a lot of like, you know, conflict, on at least in my teams. And then I tell people that we get through conflict, we work together, we need to talk about it, we go back into our sort of like the norming, we're getting our work done, we have moments where we're super performers, where we're getting a lot done, we're excelling. And then the other phase that I think is really important on teams is actually the goodbye, the adjourning, you know, and some of it is also is celebrating like our accomplishments along the way, but also at the end of projects, celebrating it. Like I really make an effort not just to say like, hey guys, we're done, you know? And there's never, you know, with research, it's hard because the publication doesn't come out for a year after the funding ends. And so it's like, when are you really done? But like you pick that time where you feel like you're sort of done with, you know, it's around the time you stop all your regular meetings and like you celebrate, like you go to dinner, you have dinner at someone's house, like you do something celebratory. Because everybody's going in different directions. They're busy because they just jumped onto a new project. And so there sometimes I think we don't celebrate the end of a team. And I think that's also like a really important part of sort of team growth and like having that moment where everybody's thanking each other. And then when you need people in the future, you can easily go back to them because people have a good memory then. They're like, hey, that was such a fun, like even if the team wasn't 100% wonderful all the time, which it never is, you remember that like, and you're like, hey, that was such a nice dinner, or we got to like all just hang out for an evening and talk about how hard that project was, or talk about our project officer, or talk about, you know, some of the challenges. So,
oh gosh, Wendy, I love this psychological development, team development, the forming, storming, norming, performing, and then adjourning and the celebrating. This is a great tool. Can you give us an example of when, can you think way back to when you first, like after your K, you started writing other grants and you started developing this skill? Can you think back to when you had some little hiccups and problems started coming up and how you worked through that? So I'm trying to get a sense of people who are listening to this. They're just now starting out. Can you share with them some of those lessons you learned along the way? And you've defined like a good process you're doing now, but where were some of the hurdles, if you can recall, that maybe our listeners might be able to anticipate when things are going to go wrong? Where might they go wrong?
Yeah. Circumstances obviously changed a lot with COVID. And so fortunately people don't have to deal with some of the crisis, but I think like the managing people in a hybrid environment is especially challenging. And I must say I've had lots and lots of challenges with this, right? Like people want to, you know, the sort of work from home now, like when you have somebody who's learning a project and is still getting onboarded, but is working from home 2 or 3 days a week, you know, how are you supervising them? How are you making sure that they're getting their questions answered? How are you making sure that they're, you know, working through things and they're not just like going into a coffee shop and hanging out all day? And so like there is this, and this is something my team really struggled with multiple coordinators. You know, coordinators are often, at least for us, and I have heard that, you know, a lot of people can hire very senior level coordinators and that does happen, but junior faculty often hire somebody straight out of college or straight out of a master's program, like someone straight out of a master's in public health. So sometimes people really even have no work experience. They went straight to college, then they get hired, or they go straight to college and then graduate school and then get hired. So sometimes even just teaching the basics of professionalism, about checking in, about setting up schedules. And it is this balance. Like I try to do that now at the beginning. In fact, I have a meeting with a new staff person tomorrow who is still kind of in that student mode to set up expectations. Which are the days you're going to be in the office? When you're not in the office, how are you going to handle your time? How are you going to check in? I've instituted this thing with my teams, and we do this now every morning. My coordinator actually does it. It's a good morning message that goes to the entire team. We use Teams, Microsoft Teams, as our communication channel. So every morning she sends it and we all write back, right? She says, good morning. And it's a little bit of like a little comment about what she's doing today. Hey, I have 3 interviews today. I'm going to be in the office for 2 hours this afternoon if anyone needs me. Otherwise, I'm running around for these interviews this morning. Hope to see you all later for our meeting. That's the kind of message, right? And then someone else writes back and says, hey, I'm today's Tuesday. I work from home on Tuesdays, just to remind everybody of that. But I'm working on a bunch of, you know, coach guides today, and I'm going to be consumed with that, but I'm available if anybody needs anything. I'll see you at our afternoon meeting, you know, like, so people write back and it creates a little bit of accountability. So we started that of, you know, when we were kind of in the stage of not knowing where our coordinators were they working, or, you know, were they hanging out with friends? Like, what are the people doing when they quote work from home? Like, creating some accountability in the mornings was helpful. I've also sometimes for some people created accountability afternoon. Hey, let's check in at 4 o'clock, or, you know, let's just touch base and make sure you don't have any questions, or how can I support you today? Cause I know that, you know, things are a little loosey goosey right now. We're just working on IRB stuff. It's not like that, you know, fun. And so how can I better support you to make sure you're feeling like we're, you know, you're busy and there's a lot going on. Mm. So time management has been hard. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, and I think the other thing is really recognizing where staff are. Like, I have a coordinator now who's extremely independent and self-motivated and self-directed, you know, among the best coordinators I've had. So if she's listening, I have told her this, but she is somebody who, like, comes to me and says, I'm done, what's next, right? Like, give me more. I like being busy. She's a very efficient person. And so with her, a lot of it is stepping back, right? Like, giving her the opportunity to be creative. I mentioned these interviews that she's doing that she tells me in the morning. She ran with those. She developed an interview guide. She set up a schedule. She did all this stuff. All I had to do was step back and peer. And when she asked me to review something, to be timely with reviewing it, and she just went with it. And other people are need a lot more support. So I think that's like the figuring out, like, you know, how much do I need to sort of support somebody? And should I be the person supporting them? I do a lot of matching people up, somebody slightly more senior, or slightly who's been there a little longer, becomes the like mentor for the new person and the day-to-day resource, like the moment to moment. Like, I can't sit by somebody all day long. I'm not even in my office all day long. And so I'll say, like, hey, did you touch base with this other person? Can you start meeting with them every other day to make sure that you get your questions answered and they're teaching you as they go? And also then they form this lovely connection sometimes, and sometimes they become friends. And I just think that's the greatest, when your staff become friends. So I do that a lot. Like, I'll have people for like their little day-to-day progress, touch base with somebody else.
Wow, Indy, I love the good morning message. I love how you're mindful of meeting people where they are and trying to connect them with peers, rather than feeling that onus is on you of, oh gosh, now I have to be the one who, no. I mean, you just shared two examples of where, no, it's not, you don't have to do these things. Some people, if you give them a little bit of space, they may, you know, knock your socks off. And it's not always up to us. There's somebody closer in their sphere that would be better suited to work with that person. So I like how you're also giving us a lesson of, it's not all on you, the faculty member, to be everything to everyone. And that's also really good leadership and good management. How, when you're talking here, Wendy, how have you been able to institutionalize really good SOP, standard operating procedures? Mm-hmm. It sounds like over the years and all your funding and all your teams, clearly there have been great things that have evolved and ideas and processes and like this good morning message. How have you been able to make sure that these things become part of like a handbook or a code book, that you don't have to reinvent a whole mm-hmm. wheel every mm-hmm. time you get a new grant? Have you been able to have that sustainable structure throughout your career and throughout the projects?
Yeah. So I'll say two things to that. So one is having really good staff overlap is always the dream, right? So as one person is leading the, there's a transition period. That's been really hard to do. I have a lot of staff turnover. And, you know, making sure that there's good communication. I also will sometimes, even when somebody leaves, I will keep them hired on as like something called a casual employee or an hourly if they're willing, and they'll put in like a few hours here and there as they start their next position, just to sort of help smooth the transition, especially if it's an abrupt transition. And so that is one, is making sure that there's good open communication for all the things that potentially fall through the cracks. But for writing things down, we do that a lot. So I have a lot of different sort of written guides to pretty much everything we do. So we have like the basics, like, which are like a guide to like running our little office. I have a tiny, tiny little staff office. But it's things like, you know, who do I contact for email issues, for administrative issues, for making purchases, for like, so it's a guide. I mean, Hopkins is a complicated place, and it's a little bit about like who you know. Like if you Googled Hopkins figuring out my email, like you still couldn't figure out who to talk to, right? So like you need to like sort of know who those right people are. And so I also do an orientation, you know, for all my staff so that they know where everything is and they, you know, physically where things are, but like where we keep all our documents and that kind of thing. All of my coordinators, I do have take a training usually, like put on by the School of Nursing. There's a how to be a coordinator training. We pay for it for them, or they could use tuition remission. But that gives them a lot of the basics of like what's a coordinator's job, especially if they're coming right out of undergrad or right out of a master's program. They've never worked as a coordinator before, and there's so many regulatory issues that they need to know. So that's really helpful. And we then keep those slides as sort of, we go back to those. Those have taught me things too about like, you know, little things that I need to remember that I do related to the IRB or things. And so we'll sometimes go back to those slides as, like you said, our standard procedures. What does this like coordinator teaching course tell us that we should be doing that's, you know, the correct way? Mm-hmm. So those are some of the things. For all of my studies, we keep what we call MOPS. So it's like a SOP, it's a manual of procedures. And so we call everything, you know, MOPS, and we have MOPS for everything. I have MOPS for retention protocols. I have MOPS for recruiting. I have MOPS for sort of everything we do. And those are helpful, but they're only helpful to the extent that we keep them updated, right? So we have to constantly go back because they're meant to be living documents. And then if someone just reads it, they still have no idea what to do. So it's like the demonstration and the observation. When we train up staff like on sort of those standard procedures, a lot of it is observation and giving them feedback, right? Like, why don't you call this participant, use this sort of script? And then they watch a few, then we have them do a few, and then we give them feedback on a few, and then they're pretty independent. And there's some people that still, that's not their thing, like to call a participant, they're not comfortable with that. And then I shift them to something else, you know, so being flexible with that. But we do have a lot of written documents and how to do things, and then do our best to keep them updated.
Thank you, Wendy. This is so valuable. Before I ask the next question, can you just set the stage? How many staff do you think you've hired over your career, and how many projects do you have ongoing now, or how many do you have right now? Can you just give us a sense of numbers? I just realized someone thinking, does she have like five staff?
So I've hired a lot of project coordinators, maybe 10 or 12, I'm going to say. I hire all different levels. So I hire project coordinators are like, typically for me, like I said, they're pretty junior. Although I have had a few senior coordinators, who have a little bit more training and skill, maybe a year of research experience makes them suddenly senior. So coordinators, I have had a lot of turnover. They tend to be with me for 1 to 2 years, and then they go do their next big thing in life, like grad school, medical school. So for a lot of them, it's not a career move. Although I do know that people have had coordinators for long, long periods of time. The staff member that has stayed with me the longest and the model that I have right now. So right, you asked me how many projects I have now. So I have three big projects, one where I'm the PI, one where I'm the co-PI or the MPI, and another, which is more of an epidemiologic study that where I'm the MPI. And I differentiate. So the first two are big clinical trials. And the second one is more of an epidemiologic kind of like lots of data, lots of statistical analysis. But for all of them, I do a lot of the staff management. So for the two clinical trials, that's the one where we have the biggest teams because there's overlap. And as we hire and onboard people, we more and more are splitting them where they do a little bit on each trial because there's a fair bit of similarity and parallels in some of the work we're doing. So for that one, I have an overarching, so for, yeah, for these two trials, I have an overarching research manager. She has been with me for 9 years. And she just got promoted. We got her promoted from being in a senior management position to being a faculty member. So she's now a non-tenure track faculty member at Hopkins, and she's expanding what she's doing, but she is the one who is sort of the point person for running our programs and our trials. So that has taken a lot of growth, right? She's been with me a long time. She started off doing intervention development, design. Eventually she started supervising some of our coordinators. And so I think of her as like the top of the chain, top of the food chain, top of the pyramid. And then under her, we have two project coordinators, one for each of the trials. And then under them, we have, well, so there's parallel staff because we have an intervention. So we have coaches who deliver an intervention. I have a coach manager who supervises the coaches. I have data collectors, and then I also have I have about 8 research assistants. And so the research assistants are very part-time people. They are master's students, they are undergraduates, and they're my like pipeline because I also often hire them when they graduate to become coordinators and other things. So, and I mentor them, and it's sort of, that's the fun work, right? Even if they don't, they're not able to put in a ton of time, they're interested and excited about this. So, and then for my other study, which is secondary data analysis, we have a smaller team, but it's been a lot of management issues too, like making sure that I have a postdoc and I have biostatistician who works with our group. And so, you know, it's also like trying to a little bit of sort of also trying to figure out like who's going to do what and the timing of all of that. So, yeah, so those are the teams. And yeah, and I think I spend on a good day, I think the HR stuff and the staff management is a lot of what I do still. It's figuring out like, you know, who's getting who, like, where do I need to post a new position? Where are my sunsetting positions? Who's moving on, you know, and getting people trained, getting people, like I said, matched up. My research manager / research associate is now doing a lot of that. And so that's the wonderful thing about like sort of growing my program and being able to mentor and elevate people to these positions is now she's going to take on more and more sort of the management. And what I will say is she is truly a multiplier. Do you know that term?
Oh, yeah. I know the book. I love the book.
I love that book. And so that's my other pearl for this is that people should really read that book. The Multipliers, do you have it, Kim? I have learned so much from those concepts and feel like when I hire people to supervise my staff, I want them to be multipliers, people who bring the best out in others, who have that understanding of how other people work best at, and And we have all worked with people that are not like that, right? Mm-hmm. The diminisher, as they say in that book, the person who is absorbed in themselves, in making themselves, making, you know, they're like a depleter. They make others feel not so good about themselves. Mm-hmm. And I can recognize that person like across the room, right? Like, you just know they're there just to elevate themselves. They don't care about other people, and they don't often know that. They don't even sometimes have the insight to know that they're that kind of manager or that kind of leader. But like, growing people that are also multipliers and that make other people feel good about their work and bring out creativity in others, I think is like part of this, right? Is that we try to be multipliers and we try to grow people who also do that.
Oh, Wendy. Wow. Dr. Wendy Bennett, she's talking about the book Multipliers, How the Best Leaders Make Everyone Smarter by Liz Wiseman. And you're clearly one of the best leaders I know to take a staff person and go through all that work to elevate her to being a faculty person, a research associate, the non-tenure track, but that's a faculty appointment here at Hopkins. That is huge. And what a message you are sending to everyone who works with you, that you are invested in them, you're committed to their growth and development, and that it may be a short stop on their journey, as you're saying, but hopefully you will impart with them some great experiences, learning a lot, making some good relationships and collaborations in the future. And you're showing, by the way, you walk the talk, what is a good leader? And if you're going to stay in academic medicine, this is how you do it. And it takes time. And so I love how you're sharing that a significant portion of your time is being mindful of all the moving pieces and parts, because by your enumeration, I counted at least, it sounds about 24, a couple dozen people between all of your coaches and your directors and all the statisticians and the research assistants. So it sounds like a lot of people. And so you can't just be completely hands off and like, they'll figure it out, sink or swim. And you also can't be in the weeds with every single solitary person. So that you're definitely demonstrating to us leadership skills that include really strong management practices. So I think this is great. And you're just making me think, oh my gosh, this is what it takes to be a division leader, then a department chair, department director, and a dean, and a president. It's all that kind of same kind of mindset and framework of multiplying people and having confidence that they can do it. Mm-hmm. But as you said, with the whole storming part of that forming, storming, norming, performing thing is preparing for the rough roads and kind of saying, you know, inevitable conflict. You said there will be inevitable conflict. So let's prepare for it and be ready for it. So it sounds like you've got it all wrapped up, Wendy. I love it.
And my division director is definitely a multiplier and is one of my mentors. So I think some of it too is having mentors who you want to do some of it. You want to supervise or manage or support people the way they do it, I think is like watching, you know, keeping an eye out for people that you think are doing it well. And then, you know, and I think like I've had people join some of my study meetings just to watch, like, how do we run a meeting? Right. And like, I'm always like, gosh, what a boring, like, you know, what a boring thing. Like, you're going to hear us sort of talk about our participants' issues and like how we're trying to do data collection better. But there is sort of like, you know, even in, it starts in the little meetings, right? Having the right agendas, making people feel valued, listened to, that there's creatives in the room, that we're not just taking charge and running with it. And yet, like, when there's, you know, we also don't want to have meetings that go on for 6 hours. And so at some point we need to make decisions. And sometimes the buck stops with me and I say, let's just do it this way. All right, you guys, we got to get off the phone. Like, you know, I'll say a couple of other, I know we're almost done, Kim, a couple of other tips that I have learned. So one, and we talked about this a little bit with the sort of end of the study, but one thing I've been doing is sort of a COVID, post-COVID thing is trying to bring people together in person in mindful ways. So actually last week we did craft night. It was actually crochet night because I wanted to learn to crochet. And three of my staff crochet like really, really well. So that we taught each other crocheting. Someone brought their needlepoint because they do that. And other people were good crocheters. Other had never touched it before. And so, you know, we all just tried and we had dessert together and played with it. So we try to do things like that, like luncheons. I'm trying to do like a quick weeknight thing. That's what the crochet thing was. So it wasn't like a huge undertaking, even on my part, like to have a lot of people over takes a lot of planning and money. And so to do something like quick and we're just all going to gather and hang out. So that's something that we've been trying to do to bring people together in a casual way. Of course, we talk a little bit about work, but we also, I learned so much from one of our research assistants who is super quiet. She had like maybe said six words before coming to crochet night. And she told us all about her life and her family in California. And like, we learned so much about her as she's, you know, sitting there crocheting. Like there's something about doing something with your hands that it kind of opens the door to conversation, which was really lovely. So that's something we've been doing kind of in this hybrid and remote work environment. And then related to that is in this remote environment is the sort of Zoom burnout that everyone talks about. And so figuring out how to have meetings that are efficient, how to have communication that is that avoids too many emails, but that you can get your questions answered quickly. And so those are some of the things that we're striving for. We actually tried doing as a team a productivity-oriented book club. We only did one. We're going to do more, I think. Maybe we'll do multipliers as our next one. Everyone could read it. But my research manager had us all read Smart Brevity, which I would recommend to you, Kim. It's good. Its subtitle is The Power of Saying More with Less. And it's all about just, it actually really helps you write for impact. And it's all about different styles of communication. I mean, there's a chapter on PowerPoint presentations. There's a chapter on meetings. There's a chapter on like brief newsletters, which I learned a lot about. Like that's like, we do that now for communicating with our participants. Like we just want to let you and staff people and, you know, quick newsletters as opposed to long emails. We all like change the way we frame our emails, like the titles to make them punchier so you get what you need like immediately and you set them up differently. In fact, I feel like I should reread it because it had like so many little tips that you can't quite adopt all of them, but they're very, very useful. So that's, and I listen to it as an audiobook, but I think I have to buy it because I think some of it is the way it looks on paper. Like it shows you sort of a format or shows you an approach to doing something which you don't quite capture in an audio format. So I'd recommend probably not that I'm putting a plug in for the purchase, but like taking out of a library or sharing it because that was a good book for us all to read, and it sort of has changed some of the way we do things as a team.
Oh yes, I see it here. So it's by Jim Vandehei, Mike Allen, Roy Schwartz, Smart Brevity, The Power of Saying More with Less. And yeah, it's like they say, think Strunk and White's Elements of Style for the Digital Age. And Elements of Style is an old-timers classic book on grammar, Strunk and White. It's like the Bible for people who are into writing. And so it's the digital age version of that. I love it. I'm definitely, I just put it in my basket. I'm going to get it. Oh, Wendy, you are amazing. I knew you would be incredible. I feel like I want to work and be one of your research assistants. Maybe when I retire, because I love science, I'll come and work for Dr. Wendy Bennett because I do crochet. Well, I crocheted all my Afghans in my house in like first or second grade. I did the double stitch and then that shell stitch, but that's about all I can remember. And it is very relaxing. And yeah, so I'm getting excited about crocheting. Wendy, you are great. I love your tips. I love all of this. Folks, isn't she great? Didn't you learn a lot? I knew you would. We're going to have her back to talk about other things. I'm just kicking myself for not having her back these all these years. But Dr. Wendy Bennett, folks, you can get in touch of her. She's here at Hopkins, and you could just simply email her at wendy.bennett, that's two N's and two T's, B-E-N-N-E-T-T, at jhmi.edu. Wendy, I'll let you say the goodbye to everybody. Thank you so much.
Thank you, everybody. This was so much fun. It's such a great topic to share. And one thing that we didn't get to do is like to hear back how other people do this, because I do think it's so nuanced and it's sort of a learn by doing. So I don't know, Kim, if you get little comments, but if you or others want to share with me their tips, I would really welcome that.
Oh my gosh, absolutely. Thanks for being on the podcast, Wendy. See you all next time.
Hey there, Faculty Factory listeners. As of April 1st, 2024, this podcast has had nearly 92,000 total downloads and YouTube views from listeners in 95 different countries. FacultyFactory.org has drawn over 42,000 web visits from users in 122 different countries. We are an international platform, and we would love to invite you to be a guest on our show. Our host, Dr. Kimberly Skorupski, makes this a very engaging and relaxing environment. And as the producer, I'll make any edits on the back end if you need it. Reach out if you'd like to be a guest or to nominate someone in our academic medicine community to be a guest. Visit the Contact Us page on facultyfactory.org to send us a message, or contact Dr. Skorupski directly at kskorupski@jhmi.edu.
Thanks for tuning in to Faculty Factory Podcast. The mission of the Faculty Factory is to build and support a community of leaders in faculty development who share tools, resources, wisdom, and encouragement in service to our faculty members, schools, and institutions. We encourage you to go to facultyfactory.org to find out more, get in touch with me, ask me any questions. Maybe you want to be interviewed on the podcast. Thanks for tuning in to Faculty Factory Podcast. We'll see you next time.
The Faculty Factory podcast and website is sponsored by the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine Office of Faculty. For more information, visit facultyfactory.org.